I want you to join me in 2 Samuel chapter number 20. We are looking at the return of King David from his exile at Mahanaim over in Gilead. Absalom was killed. The coup was over. David is returning back to the throne. The people in the United Tribes of Israel are kind of falling over one another to try to apologize to David for allowing Absalom's coup to take place in the anyway. The southern tribes of Judah, which is David's home tribe, and the associated tribe of Simeon have been very instrumental in helping him get his stuff across the Jordan River down there by the ruins of Jericho. There have been some other people who have been involved in it as well. But some of the northern tribes, the other 10 tribes, have shown up at the Gilgal area too late to have helped in that process. And they're kind of mad about it because, as they express themselves, they were the ones that first had the idea of bringing the king back. So what in the world is Judah doing, jumping the gun and bringing him back across only on them on their own? And then the Judah people are like, well, he's our relative. And then the other side is like, well, we are 10 tribes against you and the Simeonites, 2 tribes. We have more invested in him. And then they just start bickering and arguing back and forth. And I told you at the very close of last session, this helps you understand how tense things are in the United Tribes of Israel. Remember, they haven't really been united for all that long. When they asked for a king, they got King Saul, and he was the king over United Tribes of Israel for the very first time. And even then, some of the people weren't really convinced about this idea of having a leader from a tribe other than their own. He was on the throne for only 20 years. Then David came to the throne, and you remember at the very beginning of that, there was 2 years of civil war, bickering between the Benjamite supporters, that is the Benjamite dynasty supporters, and those that wanted to go with David. And then that got resolved, and then David moves the capital city to Jerusalem. Well, we are less than 38 years later from that. So we are not even 60 years of the United Tribes of Israel. And here they are fighting about who has more right to the king, who has more influence, who has more connections to the king. And this bickering breaks out into another civil war. And David's not even back to Jerusalem yet, really. Verse 1 of chapter 20. Now there happened to be there, at the argument, a worthless man, a son of Belial, somebody who is a waste of skin, is probably the best way of thinking of the idiom, whose name was Sheba, the son of Bichri, a Benjamite. So he's a Benjamite. Some Benjamites are big supporters of King David, but this guy isn't. And when the argument's going on, he decides, oh, enough is enough. He blew the trumpet, the shofar, which is, it's the signal to gather the militia together, get ready for a fight. So he blows the the trumpet and he said, "We have no portion in David. We have no inheritance in the son of Jesse." So he basically, he strengthens this argument that the Judeans don't think that the other tribes have any say in what happens with the king that comes from the Judah tribe. So apparently, we don't have a say in this matter. We aren't connected to this son of Jesse. So every man to his tents, O Israel. And so he calls for civil war, a rejection of David continuing as the king of United Israel. Verse 2, "So all the men of Israel withdrew from David and followed Sheba, the son of Bichri." So a whole bunch of the northerners that were just involved in this argument are like, fine, they want to be that way? We won't have David as our king. And so they disappear and follow Sheba. "But the men of Judah followed their king steadfastly from the Jordan to Jerusalem." So we're barely done with the Absalom coup, and now we're in a civil war. Verse 3. "David came to his house at Jerusalem. The king took the 10 concubines whom he'd left to care for the house, and he put them in a house under guard and provided for them, but did not go into them." Now remember, these are junior wives, wives probably through business arrangements within the kingdom of Israel itself. Their kids would not have, that is, their sons would not have rights to be considered as heirs to the throne. They're not part of the line of inheritance to become king of Israel. He had left them behind because he thought that they would be safe with Absalom taking over, because he had nothing to fear from them. But instead, he was advised to go in and have intimate sexual relations with each one of these 10 women as a clear indication he was done with his dad. He was totally breaking with him. And so David feels that these ladies cannot be part of his intimate circle anymore. It's a cultural thinking here. But he does put them up in a separate palace, a separate housing complex where they are fully provided for, but he has no more relationships with them intimately. So they were shut up until the day of their death, living as if in widowhood. So they become royal widows. It's as if David were already dead. They're going to live their lives like that. "Then the king said to Amasa." Now, Amasa is his grandnephew. He was the leader of the United Israeli military during the Absalom takeover. When David is coming back, remember, he told Amasa, "I swear by he who is, you're going to be left in that position as king of, or excuse me, as the commander of United Israeli forces." Because David is really ticked off at Joab, and he's not all that thrilled with Abishai, who have been his military leaders for quite some time. So call the men of Judah together to me within 3 days. Be here yourself. Now, this is in response to the Sheba civil war. He wants to call out the militia, call out the military, to be able to pursue, to chase down this rebel within 3 days. So Amasa went to summon Judah. So he apparently is sticking with the Judah connections. Only there are probably some Israelis from other tribes that are supporting David, but the focus really here is it's a rebellion against David as a Judean. Because remember, that's what the argument was. He's a Judean king first and foremost, and the northern tribes are not all that thrilled with that. If you don't recognize the wording here, this is kind of a prelude to the breakup of the kingdom of Israel upon the death of Solomon. The northern tribes, the non-Judean tribes, are going to break away from the Judean kingdom 40 years after David dies. All right, back to the text. So Amasa went to summon Judah, but he delayed beyond the set time that had been appointed him. So he kind of drags his feet, or he's just not efficient at it. Something happens where he goes beyond the three-day period. David said to Abishai, "Now Sheba, the son of Bichri, will do us more harm than Absalom." So he's kind of upset, David is, that they have not been able to strike while the iron is hot to deal with this Sheba rebellion. So he tells his nephew, Abishai, "You take your Lord's servants," that is, more military members that are under your command, "pursue him, lest he get himself to fortified cities and escape from us. So you go after him yourself." And there went out after him Joab's men. Joab doesn't really come into the story just yet because David is mad at him. David has basically fired him from being military commander and let Amasa become that. But Abishai has control of Joab's men. There's also the Kiratites. Remember, they're the sworn bodyguard of King David. And the Pelethites, those are the courier corps, and all the mighty men. They're listed in a big list of 30 mighty men. There's actually more than 30. These are the top commanders of all the different military units. So we've got a big military force heading out. They went out from Jerusalem to pursue Sheba, the son of Bichri. When they were at the great stone that is in Gibeon. Now, Gibeon is where the tabernacle is located. The Ark of the Covenant is at the palace of David in Jerusalem, and there is worship, and there is sacrifice that apparently goes on there. But the tabernacle without the Ark of the Covenant is at Gibeon, and there's still services that go on there. And we have seen in other instances that when a military operation is getting ready to start, they will sometimes stop at the tabernacle to go through a worship service, go through a blessing ceremony, probably kind of like a last chapel service before they head out into a potentially lethal military engagement. So they want to get things right with God before they leave. That's common practice. We see that in a lot of historical instances of religious members of armies. All right, so while they were at the great stone that's in Gibeon, Amasa came to meet them. So the guy that's actually in control of the army shows up to meet with those that are heading out as a pursuit force. Now, Joab was wearing a soldier's garment. He's been busted, remember. He's not a commander. He is here probably under the command of his younger brother, Abishai. So he's wearing his gear. Over it was a belt with a sword in its sheath fastened on his thigh. So the reason this is described is because of what happens next. So you have to picture him in his soldier's gear. He's got his belt. His belt has a sheath. The sheath has a sword in it. And so he goes forward to meet Amasai, or Amasa, which would be his cousin one time removed. Joab is older. He's probably in his later 50s, maybe early 60s. Amasa, probably in his 40s, maybe later 30s, early 40s. So he goes to meet his general, the guy that's actually in control of the army. And when he comes toward him, he either bows or bends over or he does something, but he does it on purpose so that his sword falls out onto the ground. Joab said to Amasa, "Is it well with you, my brother?" And Joab took Amasa by the beard with his right hand to kiss him. Now, the common practice of the Middle East at this time was that when you met someone that you were greeting, you'd either grab them with both hands by the shoulder and kiss them on the two cheeks, or if you were more intimate with them, you might actually grab them on the side of the face with your hands and kiss them on the two cheeks. You can still see this in the Middle East greetings today. So Joab has intentionally dropped his sword on the ground. He picks that up in his left hand as if it's, you know, it was an accident. I got to grab this thing up. But he doesn't sheath it. So it's in his hand. And then he puts his right hand up on Amasa's left cheek and starts to do the whole two-cheek kiss thing. But Amasa did not observe the sword that was in Joab's hand. He didn't see it or he didn't pay attention to it because, you know, it looked like it was probably an accident that he dropped it. And then Joab murders Amasai. Joab struck him with it in the stomach and spilled his entrails to the ground without striking a second blow, and he died. So he gutted him on the spot. This is the second time that Joab has murdered someone that David has made the commander of the United Israeli military. Joab and Abishai, his brother, pursued Sheba, the son of Bichri. One of Joab's young men took his stand by Amasa and said, "Whoever favors Joab, whoever's for David, let him follow Joab." So Joab is now being pumped up by his own people. Some of the people that were probably upset that David had demoted Joab and made Amasa the commander of the military forces. It's a little bit of a military coup against David's choices here. Now, Amasa lay wallowing in his blood in the highway, so he wasn't killed instantly. Joab stabbed him in the gut, probably sliced it back and forth a little bit. That's why he gets disemboweled. Amasa falls down on the ground. He's wallowing around in his own blood. Anyone who came by seeing him stopped. I mean, that's a pretty shocking sight to see the general of your forces laying on the ground, dying in front of your eyes, with your old general, who's now your new general, standing over him with the bloody knife. And so when the man saw that all the people stopped, he carried Amasa out of the highway into the field and he threw a garment over him. So when the guy who was calling for everybody to support Joab as the general again, realizes that this dying man is causing consternation amongst the troopers. He drags the body, he drags the dying guy off to the side and covers him up with a garment and just lets him expire there underneath that clothing. Because he's an impediment to Joab's military force. When he was taken out of the highway, all the people went on after Joab to pursue Sheba, the son of Bichri. Sheba passed through all the tribes of Israel to Abel of Beth-Maachah. All the Bichrites assembled and followed him in. So they head north. They're getting support from other Israelis as they go. He has particularly big support from his own townspeople, people from his tribe of Benjamin. And so they get themselves into this city of Abel. And they dig in. All the men who were with Joab came and they besieged him in Abel of Beth-Maachah. They cast up a mound against the city and it stood against the rampart and they were battering the wall to throw it down. So typical ancient warfare. One side is dug in behind the walls of a fortified city. The other side is trying to keep them from getting supplies in, so they've thrown up a cordon around the city to keep supplies out, keep reinforcements out. Then under cover of darkness or under cover of special material, they build a siege ramp across whatever ditch might be there in front of the wall. Then they bring in battering rams in order to beat at the wall, siege ladders if the wall is short enough. And it takes a while. It takes many days, many weeks, perhaps even a few months in order for siege warfare to come to its conclusion. So in this case, there is a woman inside the city that sees them settling in for this long-term fight. And she knows this never ends up well for the people inside the city. They end up going hungry. They end up with diseases. It's bad. And she doesn't want to see that for her city. Verse 16. Then a wise woman called from the city, "Listen, listen! Tell Joab to come here that I may speak to you." And so he came near her. So here he is. He's out of bow shot, out of slingshot range probably. But he starts talking back and forth with this woman on the wall. He came near her. The woman said, "Are you Joab?" And he answered, "I am." And she said to him, "Listen to the words of your servant." And he said, "I'm listening." She said, "They used to say in former times, let them but ask counsel at Abel, and so that settled the matter. I'm one of those who are peaceable and faithful in Israel. You seek to destroy a city that is a mother in Israel." So you're here trying to kill one of the cities of Israel that's loyal and trustworthy. "Why will you swallow up the heritage of he who is?" Joab answered, "Far be it from me, far be it that I should swallow up or destroy. That is not true. But a man of the hill country of Ephraim called Sheba the son of Bichri has lifted up his hand against King David. So I'm not here to destroy all of you people. That's not my goal. I'm here because a rebel against King David is hiding out inside your city. Give him up alone, and I will withdraw from the city." The woman said to Joab, "Behold, his head shall be thrown to you over the wall." And this is where we find out that Sheba doesn't have quite the support that he thought he might have in this city. The woman went to all the people in her wisdom, and after she talked to him, they cut off the head of Sheba, the son of Bichri, and they threw it out to Joab. Kind of a bloody end to this short-term rebellion. So Joab blew the trumpet, you know, the shofar, and they dispersed from the city, every man to his home. And then Joab returned to Jerusalem to the king. So all in a matter of weeks, David comes back from the terminated Absalom coup. He has this problem with the bickering between the northern tribes and the tribe of Judah and Simeon over which one of them is more attached to King David. And so we end up with this Sheba rebellion. Joab gets removed from his position as general, but as soon as he gets the opportunity, he murders the new commander of the military forces and takes that job back by force. And guess what? David is apparently too weak politically, too weak physically to stop Joab from taking this position, because we're told, verse 23, as we're wrapping up, Joab was in command of all the army of Israel. So he is back on top again. Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, was in command of the Kirathites and the Pelethites, so the bodyguard and the courier corps. Adorim was in charge of the forced labor. Jehoshaphat, the son of Ahilam, was the recorder. And Sheva was secretary. And Zadok and Abiathar were priests. And Ira, the Jariite, was also David's personal priest. Mark your place. We'll come back to even more bad news for David next time we're into the Word.